Right now, we're thrilled to have a lineup of several key speakers this morning that have very tight schedules. So let's just dive right in. I know you're eager to go. I am. First, I'd like to introduce the Department of Energy's Undersecretary for Science and Energy, Dr. Franklin Orr, who was sworn in past December. Dr. Orr is actually the first person to hold this position, as it was created by Secretary Moniz to closely integrate DOE's basic science, applied research, technology development, and deployment efforts together. In his role, he oversees numerous DOE offices, including the Department, the Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Office that I'm in, Office of Science, and ARPA-E. Before joining the Department of Energy, Dr. Orr had a long and successful career as a professor in the Department of Energy Resources Engineering at Stanford University, where he served as the founding director of the Precourt Institute for Energy. He also served as the founding director of the Stanford Global Climate and Energy Project and is the Dean of School of Earth Sciences. His numerous accomplishments and accolades, far too many to mention here. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Undersecretary Franklin Orr to the stage.
So good morning, everyone. I actually have to start with a little correction. So the Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz, is fond of pointing out to me that he was the Undersecretary for Science and Energy in the Clinton administration, and then things got separated, and now they've been put back together. So he's the last holder before me, at least. So it's great to be here this morning. Thanks, Jonathan, for the introduction. And on behalf of the Secretary, let me recognize Dave Danielson, Ruben Sarkar, and, of course, Jonathan, as the leadership of the effort that you see or you're hearing about here today. If there's any technology that we're working on that illustrates the kind of the facets of the innovation chain that we're trying to foster, it's bioenergy. Goes from the fundamental science side of the house to development to demonstration and deployment. And we have lots of activities going on in all these areas. And as so I'm the guy that's supposed to integrate the fundamental science with the applied research and technology and the commercialization side. And I can tell you, based on what I can see, that biofuels are a very important part of America's energy and economic future. And it's clear why that is if you just think about the global context of energy. On the geopolitical side, there are conflicts that range from the Ukraine to the Middle East that threaten energy stability. Our U.S. manufacturing base is fighting its way back from the ravages of the Great Recession. And each day there's a little more evidence to persuade us that we really do need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So those examples give us an indication of sort of the broader global challenges that we really need to face. Energy security is one of those. Creating good-paying jobs here in the United States is very important for us. And, of course, reducing climate change, reducing the emissions that lead to climate change. Now, these are all big challenges and ones that require us to get to work together to deal with them. And biofuels can help in each of these areas, so let me say a word or two about those. So first, energy security. It's fundamentally about energy stability and prosperity, and it has lots of components. New oil and gas finds here in the United States have changed our position with regard to oil imports in particular, the reduced price of natural gas has changed the energy mix in electric power generation. But oil, of course, will remain a globally traded commodity, and gas is getting there. And so as long as that's true, then we're subject to the market forces that lead to high or low oil prices and volatility in oil prices that influences stability as well. So being able to develop energy resources here in the United States, of course, gives us some insulation against the whims of foreign actors that may or may not have our interests at heart. So biofuels play an important role there. And as the biorefineries open and get to scale, we're closer to a domestic capability to produce cost-competitive fuels from non-food biomass resources. And that's a step along the way to creating energy independence. The second area I mentioned is job creation. According to the industry, renewable fuels, which include biodiesel, conventional and cellulosic ethanol, and advanced biofuels and their suppliers, supported, I want you to listen to the precision of this number, 852,056 jobs in 2014. I knew about the 852,000, but the 56, I wonder where we got that level of precision. In any case, it's a lot of folks, and that really does matter to all of us. In rural America, this includes new opportunities for farmers, but also construction jobs and engineers and plant technicians working across the biofuels industry. And the impacts aren't just local. This American-made clean energy technology will help families and businesses across the nation save money at the pump. The third area is the environmental benefits of biofuels. Today, cars and trucks, planes, trains, and ships account for about 30% of our greenhouse gas emissions, the second largest source behind power plants. So that's a big target and one that we need to go after with gusto. Science is clear. These greenhouse gas emissions are causing our climate to change with threats to national security, the economy, and the environment. So cutting emissions from our transportation sector depends on a mix of approaches to reducing petroleum consumption, including low-carbon biofuels. So let me say a word more about the state of play with regard to climate change. I'm guessing that many of you in this room have taken a look at the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report. It does a pretty good job of assembling the collective scientific knowledge about climate change. And it's pretty direct, this latest one, saying that greenhouse gas emissions can cause further warming, increasing the likelihood of severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts for people and ecosystems. And as we accumulate the evidence with regard to extreme weather events and their probability and sea level rise and flooding, and to be honest, I think the pH change in the ocean is every bit as important as the changes of greenhouse gas composition in the atmosphere. These are fundamental basis of the planetary systems that we count on for all kinds of services and take completely for granted, and we need to stop doing that. So this convinces me and lots of other folks that doing something about climate change is something we really do have to do. And that's why President Obama made an unprecedented commitment to combating climate change to committing the United States to leading this challenge. A couple of years ago, he laid out something called the Climate Action Plan. This plan has three parts. First, reduce carbon emissions by increasing clean energy and doubling down on energy efficiency. Next, prepare for the effects of climate change. And third, lead international efforts to combat global climate change. While he was in China last year, the president made another big step along the way by committing the United States to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% by 2025. That will double the required pace of U.S. emissions reductions from the 2020 to 25 period. So it's a big step. In some ways, 2025 seems like a long way away. It's a decade away. But for those of us who think about the scale of the energy systems that we're trying to change, it's terrifyingly close. So what that says to me is that we need to work across the full spectrum of approaches. Start now, stick with it, and work as hard as we can. And I'm convinced that we can do this. At the same time, the president of China, President Xi Jinping, declared that China would make the first ever commitment to reducing carbon emissions, announcing that it would employ 20% non-fossil-based energy by 2030. This is a really big commitment. These commitments by the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases emission in the world set the stage for what's coming up in Paris in the fall And it gives us an opportunity really to set ourselves on a path to historic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. In another important action, EPA has proposed a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions from the U.S. power sector by 2030 in a draft rule as part of the President's Clean Power Plan. There are the vehicle fuel economy standards enacted earlier in this administration that will require a doubling of efficiency of new cars by 2025. The President announced a draft rule increasing the fuel efficiency of medium and heavy-duty vehicles that would reduce carbon emissions by something like a billion tons over the life of the vehicles. So if you think about it, the U.S. emits about 7 billion tons a year of greenhouse gases. So a billion tons is starting to be a quantum that really does sound like a lot, even though, of course, that amount is not over a one-year period. So in any case, these measures are ambitious, but they're doable. If we harness the full capability of industry, academia, and the public sector to achieve them. And I'm convinced it's possible because the clean energy revolution is not something that's a distant dream in the future. It's actually happening right now. For example, solar energy has increased 25-fold since 2009. Wind energy is now 4.5% of America's total electricity generation. Electric drive vehicles are now 3% of new car sales and growing. And LED lights have been deployed at a historically rapid rate, saving consumers energy and money. So for the first time in 8 years that this conference is taking place, it's in the context of a rapidly accelerating, changing energy landscape, with renewables assuming a much bigger role. And as we've added several commercial biorefineries that have come online, biofuels are taking their place in all of that. Last week, the International Energy Agency made another hopeful prediction, saying that renewable energy, that there was a credible path for renewable energy to become the world's leading energy resource by the year 2030. Now, I'll note that this is not a simple, easy challenge. None of this happened overnight. It took a lot of research, a lot of hard work on the part of a lot of people, and we have a lot ahead. We need to work on a variety of energy resources on a variety of timescales. There's no shortage of energy out there for us to convert for our use. It's all about how creative we are in doing that. And doing it in a way that makes economic sense. So it's time to act now. It's time to get to work, and let's continue with that. So last year's grand openings of the POET and Abengoa facilities help us say that the primary technical challenges for cellulosic ethanol have been addressed. There are plenty of other challenges remaining, of course, but these projects are putting Americans to work, providing real volumes of renewable fuels, and establishing the supply chains that are needed for future refineries. And all of this, if done right, is done in a sustainable way without the use of food-based feedstocks or importing fuels from other countries. So later this year, we'll begin breaking ground on facilities to produce cost-competitive advanced drop-in fuels for the military and commercial sectors through a partnership with the U.S. Navy and the Department of Agriculture. And over the coming decades, even as we electrify a fraction of our light-duty fleet, the nation will need these drop-in fuels for heavy vehicles, aviation, and marine uses. I have to admit that among my carbon sins is flying a small airplane, and I'm having a really hard time seeing how we're going to do that with batteries. So I need you guys to make it possible for me to do something else. Of course, a number of challenges still exist which have to be addressed in order to enable wider spread deployment of additional plants. And the key components of the Department of Energy's bioenergy work are targeted at those efforts. They include R&D on sustainable, high-quality feedstock supply systems, R&D on biomass conversion technologies, and demonstration and validation of integrated biorefinery technologies up to the full industrial scale. In the President's 2016 budget request to Congress, he's asked for nearly $350 million to support all this at the Department of Energy. And this focus has really had an impact. In 2001, DOE modeled the cost of cellulosic ethanol at something like $13 a gallon. In 2012, DOE demonstrated a pilot facility at just over $3 a gallon. So that's exactly the right trend and evidence that these fuels can be cost competitive. And even as we've reduced the technical barriers, other structural barriers exist, including the availability of infrastructure and other challenges. And we're aware of these and focused on finding some solutions. And we also know that a stable investment climate to America's biofuel producers and farmers is very important as well, and we're working hard to maintain one, including through support of robust renewable fuel standards to support that work as well. So put simply, America's farmers have a friend at the Department of Energy. So let me finish by saying that if you look back over time in this area and lots of others, there have been naysayers that said it couldn't be done. But three American biorefineries have proven that to be false. There are plenty of questions still to be worked on, and I don't mean to minimize the effort that will be required. All of you in this room are the people who will make that happen. We need to work on infrastructure and costs and feedstocks and scaling of plants. But those are the kind of challenges that smart people can really work hard on and make some progress. So continue the good work that you've done so far. I'm confident that we'll succeed because the crowd in this room is as talented as any in the world. And you all are making the United States clean energy future possible. Thank you very much.